Pope Francis is dead. Russia launched a missile strike on Ukraine. Fallout from tariffs continue, as do negotiations towards an Iranian nuclear deal. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Well, the death of Pope Francis is the big story this week, dying on Monday morning. We did a whole show looking back at his legacy through the lens of Bible prophecy on Wednesday, and also look forward to what the next pope will be like. But with that done, I thought it still worth taking a couple of minutes just at the start of the show today to cover more of the news aspect of what is happening, what's going to happen next week, when you can expect a new pope to be elected. So the Pope's body has been lying in St. Peter's Basilica, where around 130,000 people have viewed it, often queuing for hours to be able to do so. He will be sealed in his coffin at 8 p.m. today in a ceremony with just the senior cardinals present. His funeral is scheduled for tomorrow. 50 heads of state and 10 monarchs are expected to be there. We're going to see a huge number of dignitaries fly in. Donald Trump is going to be there. Prince William will be there, Vladimir Zelensky from the Ukraine, Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, the French President Emmanuel Macron, and many, many more are going to be in attendance there. Around 200,000 people are expected to attend, and then at the conclusion of that, the coffin will be driven to Santa Maria Maggiore Basilica, if that's how you say it, and that's where he will be buried. And seeing all of these preparations for the funeral, I'm reminded of Mr. Gerald Flurry's article, The Dark Side of the Pope's Funeral, when Pope John Paul II died. And there you had 2 billion people watching. It was one of the biggest media events in history. I think you look at the guest list for Pope John Paul II's funeral, and it was an even bigger deal than Pope Francis's is going to be. But still, this is going to be a massive media event focused on Rome and the Catholic Church, and that is significant. Mr. Flurry in that article said, America and Britain have been mesmerized by the Pope's funeral. And in that article, he talked a lot about the role the Roman Catholic Church will play in unifying a European superpower. The role, just like he had on a recent Key of David, the role that various objects connected with Europe's Catholic history, things like the crown of Charlemagne, the attention that they are gathering. And we talked a lot more about the role that the Catholic Church is going to play in this rising European superpower back on Wednesday. So you could look back on that if you want more. But Mr. Flurry wrote there, but if we don't wake up, it is going to usher in our own massive funeral. He wrote in that article, the EU is not the friend of America, Britain, or the Jewish state in the Middle East. When will we face the truth? But all these dark events are tied directly into the best news this world has ever heard. And again, we have more of that on Wednesday. But I think the Jewish state in the Middle East, Israel, is waking up to the fact that the Catholic Church and the EU, or at least the Catholic Church, or at least Pope Francis, is not their friend. Pope Francis openly sided with Hamas after October 7th. And again, that's something we talked more about on Wednesday. But Israel has stood up to the Vatican to a certain extent, or at least Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had. He ordered a condolence tweet deleted. Israel is only sending out an ambassador, the lowest level of representation, to the funeral. Benjamin Netanyahu did put out a condolence statement recently expressing sympathy to Catholics, but also avoiding saying anything nice about the Pope. And we've got Mihailo Zekic, who is ready to talk about the Iran nuclear deal. But did you have anything to add on this Netanyahu's reaction to the Pope's death?
Yes, aside from everything you said and the history of animosity going between those two men, I think it's interesting when you compare this with Israel's reaction when Pope Benedict died like 2.5 years ago or so, maybe a little less, where they did actually send a lot more diplomats over there, which is, and like a much more fuller presence there, which is interesting because Pope Benedict, he's German, he was drafted into the Waffen-SS in World War II when he was a young man. The SS, of course, were the group that was administrating the Holocaust. Obviously, it's nothing, it's a very serious topic, but at the same time, you have, between these two funerals, Benjamin Netanyahu is treating the funeral of a former SS member with more dignity and more respect than Israel is treating Pope Francis' funeral. So that goes to show, I think, how much animosity is between those two.
And that was one of the lasting legacies, I think, of Pope Francis that we focused on the Wednesday show. But looking to the future, there will be 9 days of mourning after that funeral tomorrow before the cardinals gather for the selection process for the new pope. So that will gather sometime around May 5th or May 6th. Very, very interesting timing. That's right around the same time that Friedrich Merz is expected to take office in Germany. And I think May 5th is just an important date as well in church history. I think we could put a link to something in the show notes to give you some more information on that. But just sticking to what to expect with the Catholic Church, you'll have this conclave of cardinals that are under 80 and so eligible to vote on the new pope. They will be kind of sealed in without communication to the outside world. That'll be about 135 men voting here. 53 of them are from Europe. That's by far the biggest of any region. Asia, I think, is the next biggest region, and that has 23 cardinals. And they will basically keep voting until one candidate gets a two-thirds majority. And the rules have changed on this a little bit over time. After Pope John Paul II, he changed the rules so that if after 33 rounds of voting they still hadn't got the candidate with a two-thirds majority, well, then just a simple majority was fine. Pope Benedict scrapped that rule. Now the procedure is that if things just keep going on and on and on and nobody's got a two-thirds majority, then there's a deadline, and then only the top two candidates in the previous ballot are eligible to move forwards. These top two candidates go forwards into a runoff election, but still, there has to be a two-thirds majority before one of them is elected. In recent years, we've had popes elected relatively quickly. We haven't had these voting rounds going on and on and on. And while they're voting, the outside world will be looking at the famous smoke coming out of the chimney at the Vatican. Black smoke means no pope. White smoke is, okay, we've elected a pope. And the one there the man that the cardinals elect will be a massive influence on the world. And again, we talked on the Wednesday show a lot about what to expect from this individual, what the Bible says about this individual. In our book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy has a lot to say about what to expect from this next pope and what he is going to do for Europe and for the Catholic Church. Just to give a quick rundown of other European news, Spain became the latest EU country to announce its military spending spree. So the Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, he announced this week that Spain is going to meet NATO's minimum target spending of 2% of their GDP by the end of the year, 4 years ahead of their earlier schedule where they aim to meet this minimum spending threshold by 2029. They have been NATO's lowest spender. Last year, they only spent 1.28% of their economic output on their military. So you're getting another nation now joining Europe's rapid militarization. Then Dutch intelligence say that they were hacked by Russia. They released a report saying that Russian hackers attacked a public facility. They were fairly vague, but it was a digital control system of an undisclosed public facility in 2024. They say that the attack wasn't successful, didn't cause any damage, but we're seeing more and more of these kind of low-level attacks on Europe from Russia. We'll talk a bit more about how fear of Russia is transforming Europe when we have Jeremiah Jacques on, and he's going to talk about Russia's latest attack on Ukraine and the failed ceasefire, and we'll look a bit more about Europe's fallout there. But sticking with news from Rome, before the Pope died, we saw diplomats gather for the latest round in negotiations on the Iranian nuclear deal happening in Rome last weekend. So to get an update on that, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, as you mentioned, the talks between the U.S. and Iran were continuing at the same process we talked about last week. Mr. Witkoff, who's still leading the negotiations, Steve Witkoff, he was a bit more tight-lipped and he hasn't really said as much about what's going on. We've covered about how the things he said before relate a lot to the JCPOA, Iran, or Obama's Iran nuclear deal. But the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, on a speech he was supposed to give Monday, he pulled up, but he uploaded it on the internet. This is what he said in that speech, quote, "I want to make absolutely clear that many in Iran believe that the JCPOA is no longer good enough for us. They demand a new accord that guarantees Iran's interests while addressing the concerns of all parties. I tend to agree with this demand," end quote. So whatever went on in Rome on Saturday, and we could assume that the speech is based off of those negotiations, Iran does not want the JCPOA anymore. Iran, from their position, is we want something even better.
This is quite the development in that we've been a bit outraged and disappointed to see Donald Trump resurrecting a deal that he rubbished during his first term in office. And now Iran is actually saying, that's not good enough. We want an even better deal than Barack Obama gave us. Does it seem like Donald Trump is going to go for that?
We're, like everything else he does in foreign policy, getting very mixed signals. Later this week, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio appeared on a podcast with the Free Press, where they talked a little bit about what's going on with the nuclear program. This is what he had to say there.
"We do not want a war. We do not want to see war. This is not a president that campaigned on starting wars. And as he said very clearly, Iran is not going to have a nuclear weapon, and he reserves every right to prevent that from happening, but he would prefer it not happen. He would prefer that there not be need to resort to military force, either by us or anybody else. He would prefer that it be something that we can negotiate. The Iranians have shown a willingness to talk. We're going to talk to them. If there is a chance at peace, we're going to give peace and a peaceful resolution to this challenge every opportunity to succeed. Our priorities remain the same. If Iran wants a civil nuclear program, they can have one, just like many other countries in the world have one, and that is they import enriched material. Now, we're not going to negotiate this in the press. We're not going to negotiate this publicly because it undermines negotiations. But there's a pathway to a civil, peaceful nuclear program if they want one. But if they insist on enriching, then they will be the only country in the world that doesn't have a weapons program, quote unquote, but is enriching. And so I think that's problematic. But again, let's give peace every chance here to succeed. I don't want to see a war. The president certainly doesn't want to see one either."
So as you see there, it's a lot of mixed signals, very similar to what Mr. Witkoff said last week about trying to dial back of, like, are they going to be able to enrich? Are they going to not? I mean, the Secretary of State obviously has a bit more authority, and it looks like that is the official position. One other thing to note from what Mr. Rubio said, you heard him mention about Mr. Trump doesn't want America or anybody else to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. Anybody else would mean Israel. They're the only ones with the means and the will to do it right now. And they've been sending quite a few messages that they really want to do this right now. And it looks like this confirms something else we've been talking about on this program, that the U.S. is holding Israel back from this kind of strike. Israel, for their part, their Channel 12 released a report this week saying that the Israeli government, citing confidential sources again, believes that the talks are, quote, very, very advanced, and that Israel is really worried about this to the point where Prime Minister Netanyahu called an impromptu meeting with security personnel this past week to figure out how Israel should respond about this. So whatever's going on looks like Israel can see that its security is being undermined one way or another.
This development has kind of caught us by surprise. And we didn't expect Donald Trump to be resurrecting the Iranian nuclear deal. So, you know, we have Bible prophecy as our guide. But even with that, there's lots of things to say that God hasn't necessarily revealed. Or there's a lot of things that are open to individual choice, individual action. So how does this story tie into Bible prophecy?
Well, the big one would be a scripture we go to often on this program, Daniel 11, verse 40, that our editor-in-chief has pointed to being a prophecy. Now I'll read it. Quote, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. This is an end-time prophecy, as the scripture mentioned. It features two geopolitical players. Mr. Fleury has pointed to the King of the North being Europe and the King of the South being radical Islam led by Iran. You can read the rest of the prophecy going into Daniel 12, showing this is the spark that triggers a crisis of unparalleled magnitude going around the whole world. And Mr. Fleury has pointed to Iran and its pushiness and its provocation towards the West as being a part of this, and especially its nuclear program. We talked a bit on this program last week about how Europe is getting a little bit antsy with these negotiations going on. They were on board before, they're not on board now, but America's still going full steam ahead. And there's good reason why. Mr. Fleury gave a Key of David episode in 2019 about Europe and Iran clashing and why Europe's afraid from Iran. We could play that clip now.
Now I want to read you just one more quote here that's really important, one that we have wrote and quoted a man that knows what he's talking about. Former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Dory Gold, said that a nuclear Iran can't be deterred like the Soviet Union was during the Cold War. Well, why not? Why can't they be deterred like another nation, let's say another nuclear nation? Well, here's the reason. The Iranians have a much more radical belief system. They think their savior, their Messiah, you could say, the 12th Imam, or Mahdi, will return sooner if they cause more apocalyptic chaos and violence. As Gold pointed out, quote, anyone who says with confidence that the West can get used to nuclear Iran and rely on classic deterrence models has absolutely no idea what he is up against. It's not like any other nation in the world because of their radical beliefs that they think more violence can hasten the return of their 12th Imam. Now that's what they believe, and they're willing to die for that. How are you going to deal with a nation like that? And they, of course, have been proving that for some 30 years. You can see see their actions and see the fruits of what they've been doing. You can figure that out, figure a lot of this out just by looking at what's happening. Who is dominating the Middle East?
So everything that Mr. Fleury said there, Europe knows that. And for the record, that Keith David episode aired in the first Trump administration. That was a concern even back then. And to see Mr. Trump take a very different turn in nuclear affairs with Iran, in helping normalize what's going on there to one degree or another, you could be sure this is going to be getting under a lot of people's skins. What exactly, like you said, there's individual choice going to be involved, and Mr. Fleury very recently has said that a lot of these foreign policy dealings the effects of them are going to be based on the choices the president makes. But that's still the general trend we're watching for. And if it continues down this path, these nuclear negotiations, it looks like we could see a nuclear Iran much sooner than we'd think. And his book, The King of the South, is a good one-stop shop to delve into that particular prophecy I mentioned and a lot more on why Iran is important, what we're watching for, and how Iran fits into Bible prophecy.
And I think another article that we could put in our show notes on this is from our latest Trumpet print edition, The Fatal Flaw in Trump's Foreign Policy. This is in our latest Trumpet print edition that talks about this and other flawed deals that we'll talk about with Jeremiah in just a moment. But that Trumpet print article gives you an in-depth look at the Bible prophecy as relates to some of the biggest, most important stories. And you could get your own free subscription to that if you go to the website, thetrumpet.com. If you just scroll down a bit on the right, you can read our latest Trumpet print edition online. You can download it. You can also put in your details so that you can get it in the mail for free every month. There's no catch. There's no follow-up. There's no request for payment. It is a six-month subscription, but it's not a six-month kind of initial trial period to try and get you hooked. It's just, we don't want to be sending this to you year after year after year if you don't want it and you're not reading it. So after 6 months, we just have a little card in there that says, hey, are you still interested? If so, just go to this website to tell us or give us a call to tell us and we'll keep it coming. So we'd be very happy to send you that. And The Fatal Flaw in Trump's Foreign Policy is the cover article of that latest Trumpet print. And so much of that Trumpet print is just becoming more and more relevant. I mean, there's an article on who the next pope is going to be in there. Written, mailed out before the Pope died, but very relevant to the news right now. I think you had another couple of stories, at least to bring us on important news from the Middle East before we let you go, Mihailo.
Yes, as you, and it actually ties in with what we just talked about with Israel getting antsy with what's going on, everything here. There was a report in Bloomberg yesterday titled, "Trump Ally Holds Talks with Syrian Leader on Sanctions Israel." And it details a conversation they had with U.S. Representative Corey Mills, who went on a fact-finding, an unofficial fact-finding trip to Syria, talked with the president there, the new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, the leader of the al-Qaeda-affiliated group that now controls the government in Syria. And the main subject of discussion was sanctions relief. For obvious reasons, Syria is still under very crippling sanctions. But this is a little put in almost as a footnote, but I think the most important part of it, quote, Mills said Sharaa is open to addressing U.S. concerns and told him Syria was interested, under the right conditions, in joining the Abraham Accords, which saw the United Arab Emirates and other Arab countries normalize ties with Israel during Trump's first term, end quote. We could literally have, if this is to be believed, and if the ball gets rolling on this, we could have a government that used to be associated with al-Qaeda, that's still an Islamist group, that's still classified as a terror group by the international community, recognizing Israel. I'm sure this is not out of altruism. Again, Syria is under crippling sanctions, and I think the government there wants to do whatever they can to get those sanctions removed. Making peace with Israel is probably the most overt sign they could give that they're a different government, and Israel, for its part, it's had a bit of a free hand in southern Syria, dismantling old weapons depots and other things like that, and Sharaa probably wants that ended. The indication is his main desire for this is that Israel return the Golan Heights to Syria, which is never happening, but with negotiations, who knows what's going to happen with that. And on the flip side, even if Israel might get a little bit scared of this al-Qaeda government, if they do go ahead with this, we have plenty of material on our website of why these Abraham Accords with these more so-called moderate Arab countries, as well as countries like Syria, Israel is trusting in them to its own detriment, and it's walking into a trap of its own making. Mr. Fleury had an article called The Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals from a few years back about these. That was about the UAE and Bahrain, which aren't like radical Islamist governments. Syria, in this case, is. And if Israel does walk in this down this path, this could spell a lot of problems for it. One other quick story from the Middle East. The Palestinian Authority yesterday approved creating the role of a vice president to Mahmoud Abbas. That's the kleptocratic dictator in the Palestinian territories. That's on, I think, his 21st year of his five-year term now. The fact that they're creating this role, he's 89, suggests that he might be grooming a successor and trying to give him a formal office. That's how he got into power when Yasser Arafat was over the Palestinian territories. Nobody has been named yet, but we'll certainly keep an eye out on that.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. We've been talking a lot about flawed peace deals. One of the big focuses over this last week has been a push to have a truce over the Easter weekend with Russia and Ukraine, and then how that has developed, a peace conference in London, and a Russian attack on Ukraine during those negotiations. To get the latest on that, we'll look to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. I'd like to start off with that attack that you mentioned by Russia. This was one of the deadliest strikes on civilian targets, really, of the whole war. This was a strike on targets there in Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. And this came at a time, as you said, when it really bodes ill, I think, for the attempts to bring an end to this terrible, terrible war. So this was Thursday morning, starting around 1 a.m., that Russia began striking Ukraine's capital with just a barrage of missiles and drones. Kyiv, of course, is nowhere near the front line of the war. It's almost 100 miles east, and there's no chance of anyone accidentally thinking that there could be military targets there in these residential neighborhoods that were hit. But Vladimir Putin, of course, has been striking civilian targets pretty much since the beginning of this full-scale war more than 3 years ago. So it should not surprise us to see him continuing this tremendously wicked tactic. But he did strike Kyiv at least five different neighborhoods over a period of 11 hours with 66 missiles, including some North Korean models, and 145 drones. And it was a big success for Vladimir Putin. He was able to kill at least 12 people, including six children, and he was able to wound another 90 people, including many more children, in many cases very seriously, with limbs blown off and other life-changing injuries. So Putin accomplished his goal here, killing some kids as they lay sleeping in their beds and killing and maiming many others. And this was the largest attack on Kyiv in about 9 months. And it's interesting that it happened when it did, because as you said there in the introduction, this week there's been just a whole flurry of activity from the Trump administration trying to bring an end to the war. That was, of course, one of President Trump's big campaign promises. And this week, he said that if Russia and Ukraine don't make peace soon, that he will walk away from even trying. But shortly after that, Mr. Trump unveiled what he called his final offer to make peace. And the deal that he presented, it really seems to give quite a lot to Russia and to just, you know, take almost everything away from Ukraine. So it was a lot of the same points that we've heard before. Russia can keep the territory that it currently controls. And there are some promises that Ukraine will not join NATO as well. And then there were also some items there that were somewhat new in this plan. There was one item stipulating that America would lift all sanctions on Russia. And then there was also a plan mapped out for the United States and Russia to become close partners in the industrial and energy sectors. And a big part of that plan was that the United States would actually take over Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. That is the biggest nuclear power plant in all of Europe. And President Trump said that America will take charge of it and pump its energy into Ukraine and Russia alike. And that would be kind of an important first step in a new, very deep America-Russia energy partnership. So Mr. Trump seems very eager to shake Putin's hand in this new energy partnership. And then there was also a point saying that America would officially recognize Crimea as Russian territory. And then another point said that Ukraine could have some security assurances, but that point was very, very vague. It didn't mention America helping at all to enforce that security. So Ukraine was unimpressed by this deal, and President Volodymyr Zelensky opted not to sign it. The Ukrainian people are adamantly against this, so really he didn't have any mandate to sign it. And that was infuriating to President Trump. So he took to social media to really castigate the Ukrainians and blame them for prolonging the war. And all of that was messy and convoluted enough. But then, to top that all off, Russia executed this attack on Kyiv on Thursday, killing children in their beds as they lay sleeping and wounding many others. And President Trump was not happy about that attack. It's rare, actually, to hear criticism of Russia from President Trump, but he did post that he was not happy with the attack. And then his post said, quote, "The strikes are not necessary and very bad timing. Vladimir, stop." So President Trump does not appear to be walking away, even though peace remains elusive. It actually, to many analysts, it seems like Putin is mocking Mr. Trump with this brazen attack right in the middle of these negotiations. And it shows, I think, that peace could still be very far off. And it shows that the U.S. is quickly losing what little credibility it might still have left on the global stage. But Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, he wrote about rulers such as Vladimir Putin several months after Putin's war went full scale. And he actually pointed to a verse in the book of Daniel in the Bible that says these kinds of leaders are so power hungry and so inhumane that they have the mind essentially of a beast. That's the word that the Bible uses there. And in this article, Mr. Fleury actually berates President Trump for believing that he could make peace with a ruler like Putin and become a friend to him and a partner to him. One section of this article says, "Mr. Trump believes he could negotiate with Vladimir Putin, giving him sections of Ukraine and expecting this to pacify him. That reveals a total lack of comprehension about who he is dealing with. Then a little further down, Mr. Fleury writes, President Trump said that Putin is a man that he got along really well with. Is that true? Is that wise? Should anyone get along with an evil man like the Prince of Russia? Can God get along with the devil? So there is Mr. Fleury's assessment of Mr. Trump's efforts to kind of give in to Putin and to make, you know, energy deals and partnerships and things like that with this man who routinely fires on civilian targets and kills children in their sleep. You know, it's a scathing condemnation of these kinds of efforts. Mr. Fleury's article shows that America should be doing a lot more than just sending off a tweet that pathetically kind of begs for Putin to stop. And it shows that if the U.S. stays on this current path, there will be some very dark days ahead. And for anyone who would like to understand these disturbing current events in the context of Bible prophecy, I would encourage them to read that article from Mr. Fleury that I quoted from. It's called The Ukraine War Will Not Start World War III.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And I think, and one of the things that also stood out to me is it did seem like some of the provisions from President Trump and some of Russia's responses were less about bringing peace to Ukraine and more about, say, a grand strategic bargain between the United States and Russia. And you talked about energy infrastructure. And this seems like this was not the end of the deal, but this was designed to be an important step towards kind of draw. I saw one commentator refer to it as a new Yalta. Like, we draw a line on the map, and this section is Russian territory, and they get to kind of, or Russian control, their sphere of influence, they get to do what they want. This section is the United States territory. And what I thought was interesting about the Yalta comparison, of course, is the big difference between now and 1945, where there was this previous grand bargain, in that in 1945, Germany was prostrate and in ruins, and that is very much not the case today. And so that means that any grand bargain is going to look very different and have very different ramifications. So if Donald Trump comes along and Vladimir Putin, and they do something like this and they draw a line on the map, then this is probably fatal for NATO. Certainly if some NATO countries end up in the Russian zone, that is the end for NATO. I don't want to say that as if NATO is kind of this powerful force right now. I mean, arguably NATO's over already, and we've been calling out for years things that Germany have been doing undermining NATO. America is not the one to like solely responsible for the destruction of NATO by any means. Even France has been kind of, you know, they want to do their own thing. Like, NATO, was it Macron called NATO brain dead? But it would be a very public declaration that NATO is dead. And the big result of this will be a Europe that looks to itself for its own security. And ultimately, this would send a lot of countries looking to Germany as their champion instead of the United States.
You know, I think that's an excellent point. I think the fact that President Trump included a clear clause about lifting all sanctions apparently immediately on Russia, it does point to something larger, you know, kind of that he would like to fashion here. And I think you make an excellent point there about the fact that this would not be a bilateral agreement like Yalta in many ways was. You do very much have a third party. The Germans and Europe behind them are very much a player this time around. So it would be considerably more complex to have, you know, it's just a more complex dynamic this time.
And this point about Eastern Europe, or all of Europe really turning to Germany and Russia's rise, prompting Europe to look to Germany in that way, is something Mr. Fleury also talks about in that same article that you mentioned, The Ukraine War Will Not Start World War III. He talks about Barack Obama and the way that he threw Ukraine under the bus in that article. And I think we're looking at continuation, really, of Obama foreign policy potentially in Ukraine, just like we are with Iran. But Mr. Fleury talked about when Barack Obama failed to honor America's commitment to defend Ukraine. And he said, when this happened, nations all over Europe, especially Eastern Europe, trembled with fear. They realized they could not count on the United States for protection against Russia. He cites an article that he wrote in 2014, The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe, where he wrote, after they gained their freedom from the Soviet Union, Eastern Europeans trusted in America. Some of these nations became members of NATO. Then they watched as Russia began to get aggressive again. They hoped to receive support from America, defending them from that aggression. But now they see America's will is broken. And I think the fact that you see Obama throwing Ukraine under the bus, and now you see an administration that is dramatically different in many ways to Barack Obama's, but still one that is not willing to defend Eastern Europe, that just really ramps up that fear and adds to that urgency of, okay, we need an alternative. We cannot rely for our freedom and our independence on the United States. And so going back to that article, Mr. Fleury writes, immediately Europe buzzed with renewed urgency over how to protect itself apart from America by strengthening and unifying politically and militarily. The nations also began looking as never before for more leadership from Germany. This was truly startling after all that Germany had done to terrorize Europe in the past. Even nations like Poland, which had suffered so much at Germany's hands, began to fear Russian aggression more than Germany's more warmongering history. America's weakness and Europe's unification are both crucial prophetic trends, and they have both advanced as a direct result of Russia's attack on Ukraine. And that article was from 2023, during Biden-Obama time in office. But we're seeing more of that, and that is another crucial prophetic trend to watch, Europe uniting in fear of what is happening, what Russia was getting away with. Well, I believe you had some more stories as well that are prophetically important from Asia to update us with, Jeremiah.
Yes, that's right. First up, China continues its charm offensive, just trying to rally other Asian nations behind it as it tries to really keep from giving in the trade war with America. And as China, just continues working to try to pull nations deeper into its orbit, this week it was Indonesia that the Chinese set their sights on. Indonesia is not at all an insignificant nation. It is the world's fourth most populous country, and it has the 13th most powerful military, according to the latest Global Firepower Index. So Indonesia is powerful, and it has the capacity to be even more powerful. And China's trying to make it a close partner. So it was on Monday that foreign ministers and defense ministers from the two countries held a series of meetings about how to deepen their strategic cooperation and their defense cooperation as well. They agreed to some maritime deals for the South China Sea on top of this, and just a whole raft of other agreements about security cooperation. So China seems to have made some notable progress in pulling Indonesia into its orbit. And that kind of unification between Asian nations, that's something that the trumpet has been warning about for decades. And then I've got one final story here about Japan. The Japanese, they see that the U.S. ship is sinking. They see that Russia and China are becoming very aggressive and bent on regional domination there. And Japan has been doing a good bit of work on its own, really trying to build a bloc of Asian nations under Japanese power that would be kind of a counterweight to what's forming under China. So Japan has recently been building all kinds of ports and railways and power grids in places like the Philippines and Malaysia and Vietnam. It kind of presents this as a transparent alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. And then Japan has even donated a bunch of patrol vessels to some nations, including Vietnam and the Philippines, just to help them stand up to China's illegal activity in their waters. And the Japanese are even engaging with South Korea a great deal lately, which is, historically quite anomalous. And then just this week, Japanese Prime Minister Sugihira Ishiba said that he will begin a four-day trip to Vietnam and the Philippines starting on Sunday to build stronger economic and security ties with both nations. So the Japanese are slowly but steadily building kind of an informal coalition of Asian partner countries and placing Japan at the head of it. But we know that, biblical prophecy tells us that this rival bloc, even if it does come together successfully, it'll eventually still be absorbed into that Russo-Chinese alliance. So it's a noble effort, I think, on Japan's part, but we should not expect it to last long.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We've been talking about how Russian aggression will prompt Europe to unite. Another thing that will be crucial in prompting Europe to come together, and has already been crucial in prompting Europe to come together, is a financial crisis in the United States. Here's what Herbert W. Armstrong had to say about that on his World Tomorrow program.
The present economic crisis threatens the very existence of the United States of America. Now, that statement ought to be thundered in banner headlines, filling the whole upper half of the front pages of newspapers, and also thundered out in newscasts. But this crisis, the financial crisis, is more serious than the world understands. It not only concerns the United States and Latin America, it is a world economic crisis. I was in London recently at the time of the economic summit of the most powerful nations. And I had meetings there with some of the heads of government. And I can tell you that they were even holding back a lot of the seriousness of the economic situation at this present time. What is happening can suddenly force a unification in Europe, a United States of Europe, that will produce a new world power, a world power colossus, perhaps larger than either the Soviet Union or the United States, and formed for the very purpose of destroying the United States of America. And that very fact is foretold in your Bible, in the prophecies of the Bible, believe it or not.
Well, that was Mr. Armstrong talking about a financial crisis developing in his day. Now, that wasn't the dramatic crisis that ended up bringing everything crashing down, but he talked about what is prophesied to happen with these financial crises and how they'll impact Europe and the whole world, and set that up quite dramatically. And I thought it was a great introduction to Andrew Miller's story, talking about the financial turmoil that the United States has been going through. So, I mean, Andrew, what is your latest update on the U.S. financial situation?
Yeah, those were just some powerful quotes from Mr. Armstrong. And the U.S. financial crisis has been something that's been building for decades. When Mr. Armstrong made those comments, actually, the United States was still the biggest creditor nation in the world. But there were already problems developing then. It's since moved with the United States is no longer the biggest creditor nation in the world. It's now the biggest debtor nation in the world. Our debt to GDP ratio is up to 124%, and we are nearing just a global financial crisis with breathtaking speed. Back in the 80s, Mr. Armstrong was warning about these things, largely based on Bible prophecy. Now we've got more and more economic analysis warning that there's going to be an economic crisis just based on the math. Our listeners have probably heard a lot of reporting about economic crises in regards to President Donald Trump's tariffs. Ray Dalio, a hedge fund investor at Bridgewater Associates, has given several interviews over the last couple months, even featuring prominently in a Newsweek article this week, saying that something worse than a recession is coming. And the thing that's worse than a recession is a depression. And I think his latest interview on that, he really did a good job at breaking it down that Trump's tariffs could be the trigger for this depression. But the tariffs themselves aren't actually the problem. The problem is this level of tariffs at a time when America's debt to GDP ratio is as high as it is. He gave a clip where he's really just sitting down and explaining. He's like, he said, the important thing to watch is the debt to GDP ratio. Having a $36 trillion debt, even though that's a huge number, isn't necessarily a problem if your economy is bigger than $36 trillion. America's economy is not bigger than $36 trillion. It's only about a $30 trillion economy with a $36 trillion national debt. You do the math, it comes out to about 124% of GDP, which means that about 3% of everything produced in America in a year is being paid in interest on the national debt. And it's that statistic, the percent of GDP that goes to interest on the national debt, that will cause the financial crisis. Once the percent of GDP that goes to interest is too big, you can't afford other things. And you're getting close to into like bankruptcy territory. So Ray Dalio, and I think his math's pretty good. He's like, well, he said the U.S. economy, it normally grows 2 or 3% every year. So he's like, if the national debt only grew 2 or 3% every year, the debt to GDP ratio would be constant. The percent of the economy that goes to interest payments would be more or less constant. You could probably muddle along for a while. But that's not what's happening. The debt, the deficit last year, the U.S. government spent 7% of everything made in America was just the deficit, the amount of money it borrowed. Trump's tariffs might produce some new revenue, lower that a little bit down to 6%. But we're borrowing money at twice the rate the economy is growing, which means your ratio of debt to GDP is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And the amount of money that's going to the interest on the national debt as a percentage is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So now you come along with like Liberation Day and you get these tariff announcements, which in a time when the U.S. economy was more healthy, might even be warranted to bring some industry back to America. These tariff announcements, because tariffs, I mean, like any economic decision, they have their pros and cons. They do hurt overall GDP growth, but they bring some vital industries back to the nation. So those tariff announcements could reduce America's GDP about 1% a year. Normally, I, for one, would say that like in more normal times, like if we had to sacrifice 1% of our GDP growth in order to like open up factories that actually make bullets and stuff like that in America, so you don't have to buy those from other nations, that's probably an acceptable sacrifice. But you don't want to take a 1% hit to your GDP at a time when your debt to GDP ratio is already 120%. And you're borrowing 6% of your GDP and then sending half of that, 3%, to interest. Because when you do that, the interest payments just get so much that I think you even ask, and this isn't my math, you can actually go to the Congressional Budget Office and they'll tell you in their reports that by the year 2044, which is like not too far from now, every penny of tax revenue in the United States is going to be going towards Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the national debt. So everything that we buy that's not an interest payment or an entitlement program is funded off deficit spending. Now, you'll never get there. The economy will collapse long before you get to that point. Which is why I think Ray Dalio's warning here is so premonition, saying that, like I said, if you don't actually get the budget deficit down below 3%, you're going to have an imminent financial crisis. And Trump's tariffs could even push us to that point even faster unless there's drastic spending cuts. I think President Trump must be at least somewhat aware of this because his DOGE department was a big part of his administration. But so far, the latest Senate budget proposal I've seen is like they actually haven't cut a penny of spending overall. So we're on pack to do another 6% budget deficit this year, which combined with the tariffs could make it to where not only is that financial crisis that Mr. Armstrong prophesied to come still coming, it's probably coming within a year or two.
And this lack of urgency, I think, is really astonishing about this. I mean, you mentioned Doge, for example. One of the headlines from this week is Elon Musk stepping back from Doge. I think he said he's only going to spend a couple of days a week on this starting next month. So, I mean, that's just less than a week away. And generally, there's a lot of people, a surprising number of people in America that I think view this as a good thing and are rejoicing. Like, there's no sense that we have a crisis coming. We're about to drive off a cliff. We do desperately need to cut a lot more than what Doge is doing. I mean, Doge is kind of making the easy cuts, the painless cuts, relatively, whereas we need that and more if we're going to get the spending under control. But it's like this has just been an issue for so long. You know, there's the Ronald Reagan quote about, are you worried about the deficit? No, the deficit is big enough to take care of itself. Like, we have been hearing this being a problem, and we have not had a financial crisis that fundamentally wipes out the American economy or impoverishes the majority of people. So we're now moving on, and like we're not worried about it for that reason. We've heard about it for so long, and nothing has happened.
Yeah, I think that is a good point. I've also been pretty disappointed with the progress with Doge because Elon Musk, he has actually generated quite a few painless cuts, like just government waste that we should have never been spending money on anyway. But so far, for pretty much every cut he's made, they've found something else to spend it on. Maybe something more important, but still spending. I also think you make a good point, too, about just people getting numb to it, because, like I said, we've been talking about this since the Reagan era, and no financial crisis has come yet. But I think the market's getting that jittery at just a 1% drop shows that that debt to GDP ratio is high enough that if it gets any higher, we're in real trouble. That's going to cause a financial crisis in the United States that, like Mr. Armstrong said in that beginning quote, is going to have to prompt Europe to start uniting. I've even seen a couple articles saying that if from European leaders saying that like we need to offer a Eurobond alternative to the Treasury bond that's backed by a central European government, and the way that Treasury bonds are backed by the U.S. government. A lot of people in Germany and the Netherlands and some of the more fiscally responsible European nations are going to hate that because they don't want to co-sign on a loan with nations with debt problems. But that's the only reason Europe hasn't united into a fiscal union already. They didn't want to surrender the sovereignty. But like Mr. Armstrong said, it's like this crisis, if the American bond market just tanks and America's going into a recession or even a depression, Europe doesn't have a lot of options but to get nations to start surrendering sovereignty to a central financial authority that can produce a bond that's more trustworthy than the U.S. bonds. If you look, I did the math, actually. If you look at the European Union overall, average all the nations, its debt to GDP ratio is only 88%, and America's 124. So if you could get those nations together to say that, like, we're jointly guaranteeing those bonds, as an investor, I would totally buy a euro bond in that case as opposed to a U.S. bond, just because Europe's debt to GDP ratio is just way healthier than America's is.
So this is paving the way for a new global financial system. It's basically setting up Europe to take over as a new financial system, which, believe it or not, is something we also talked about as kind of the legacy of Pope Francis on the Wednesday show, on this prophetic shift from a US-led financial system to one based in Europe. But Andrew, you had some other stories as well of prophetic significance going on in the English-speaking world.
Yeah, a couple other things. This next one's probably a symptom of America's financial problems. As we keep spending more and more money on our debt, we keep having to scale back on our overseas commitments. We had an announcement this week that the United States is withdrawing over half its troops in Syria. The withdrawal, it's going to decrease U.S. manpower in the region from about 2,000 U.S. troops to less than 1,000. So definitely creating, that's a volatile region, a power vacuum in the Middle East that we know from prophecies in Daniel 11 and other places that Europe's going to fill. They're going to have to step in and confront the King of the South, start taking responsibility for the Middle East as America pulls out what few troops it has in that region. And then a couple disturbing moral stories. We keep hearing about this showdown between President Trump and Harvard, where there's been so much anti-Semitic protest on Harvard, and these Harvard instructors are just instilling deep hatred for the Jews and their students, that President Trump, he now wants to cut funding to Harvard. He's like, we don't need to be using taxpayer dollars to indoctrinate our students in anti-Semitism. But they actually came out with an Anti-Defamation League report now that anti-Semitic crimes in the United States, they've reached record levels for the fourth year in a row, having documented well over 9,000 cases of anti-Semitic crimes in America last year. And then in some of the other English-speaking nations in Britain, they said that personal thefts in both England and Wales were up 22% this year from last year. That's like a sizable jump, 22%. Says here, the data from the Office of National Statistics shows police records that 152,416 thefts were committed last year, which is the highest level since they started keeping record in 2003. So just showing, and neither England and Wales are in like a recession, depression type condition at the moment. So I don't think it's desperation that's driving people to thievery, but just showing that that is on the moral front, something that's apparently becoming more acceptable now than it was in past generations.
I think it also shows something about migration in the UK. There's been a lot in the news this week about the government being forced to publish the so-called migrant crime league table of nationalities that commit crimes. I think that we're still waiting for those results. But based on data that was published in January, for somebody who's British, per 1,000 people, there are 12 arrests. Somebody from Somalia, there are 65 arrests per 1,000 people. Iraqis, 93 arrests per 1,000 people. Albania, 210 arrests per 1,000 people, which is just astonishing. I mean, if that was a different person arrested every time, that would mean that one in five Albanians were criminals. Now, instead, you're probably getting some of the same people arrested again and again and again, so that wouldn't be the case. But that's still an astonishingly high level. So by importing, just like in the US, by importing all these migrants, we're importing huge amounts of crime, and the government seems completely impotent on the matter. Well, thank you for those stories, though, Andrew, and to Jeremiah, Mihailo, all of our contributors. Thank you very much to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production, and to Isaac Lorenz as well. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Next week, we should be playing the On Location episode that I filmed in Brussels on Wednesday, barring any other massive development like a pope dying or something like that. So until then, keep watching your world.